You're listening to the Hayek Program Podcast. This podcast includes audio from lectures, interviews, and discussions from scholars and visitors of the F.A. Hayek Program for Advanced Study in Philosophy, Politics, and Economics at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. To learn more about the Hayek Program, visit hayek.mercatus.org. To learn about graduate student fellowship opportunities with the Mercatus Center at George Mason University, for students at Mason as well as at universities across the globe, please visit students.mercatus.org.
Hello and welcome to the Hayek Program Podcast. I'm Stephanie Halfley, a senior research fellow with the Hayek Program. This episode is our second installment on the series on the book Living Better Together, Social Relations and Economic Governance in the work of Ostrom and Zelizar, edited by me and Virgil Storr. The conversation that follows is with Laura Grube, an associate professor of economics at Beloit College. She's also an alum of the PhD fellowship, and Anne Hobson, who got her PhD in economics from George Mason University, is an alum of our MA fellowship program and now works in public policy. We discuss institutional diversity, community, and crisis resilience. I hope you enjoy the discussion. Laura's chapter looks at community recovery, and Anne's chapter, co-authored with me, looks at remittances in Cuba to look at this lens as well. So thank you both for joining me today.
Thanks for having me.
Likewise. Thank you.
So to get us started talking about these ideas, how familiar were you with Eleanor Ostrom and Vidiana Zelizar's perspective and their respective projects before working on these book chapters? Laura, do you want to start?
Yeah. So I am an economist by training. So I, as you might guess, was more familiar with Eleanor Ostrom's work. And I had read Eleanor Ostrom actually as an undergrad and then more in graduate school. I had incorporated her into my own research. So I was more familiar with her. That said, I come from kind of a liberal arts, so reliance on a lot of interdisciplinary, or we might say multidisciplinary thinking and ways of learning. So I'm familiar with economic sociology. I really appreciated the opportunity to dig into Zelizar. And I think I found quite a few similarities with Lynn Ostrom. And I think as an economist, it's good. You know, we need to get into the habit of engaging people in other disciplines, and I look forward to reading more economic sociology from here on out.
Anne?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure you recommended both Ostrom and Zelizar to me. So I got a copy of Governing the Commons by Ostrom and Economic Lives by Zelizar when I was a graduate student, and they inspired me to choose economic sociology as one of my fields for doctoral studies. Talk about a bunch of great women mentors, including yourself. I was also able to work with individuals who had worked with Ostrom directly in my graduate studies. That was Dr. Paul Dragos Alajica and Dr. Bobby Herzberg. And the thing that struck me the most from their books and papers was how right they felt in terms of what interacting with social sciences should be. There were stories and real life examples from which principles and characteristics were derived. Terms like economic circuits conjure up diagrams like an electric circuit, but the examples that were used, things like credit associations, where individuals without access to credit pool and then distribute capital, brought that circuit off the paper and into reality. The same was true with polycentric governance, where many people, institutions, et cetera, contribute to rule formation and enforcement. That's quite an abstract and complex theoretical concept until you're talking about how people are navigating water rates in Spain and California and what that looks like and how they develop mechanisms to best do that.
Yeah, and I've had the pleasure to co-author with both of you, and I think, you know, something that's really interesting about Ostrom in particular was how collaborative she was. You know, Zelizar does as well, and her students and how they take on these ideas afterwards is really inspiring, but I think they both kind of bring something to the table that we all are particularly interested in, you know, this idea of multiple methods, fieldwork, surveys, those sorts of things. And then also just explaining, and this gets into our next question, kind of like explaining things that are so obviously true about social life
that we sometimes overlook in academic perspectives. And so from that, I think, you know, clearly that's a thing that I think is very important that comes from them individually and together. But what do you think is some of the most important things to glean from their research and, you know, particularly, you know, on their own, but also what you think that is when it kind of comes together?
Yeah. Research that involves human action should be somewhere between science and story. So if you have science, but not a story, it's really easy to lose sight of human agency. But just as you said, I think it's important in terms of a lesson that we should all be interdisciplinary and it's okay to use multiple methods. So my chapter leverages reviews of documents, but also an online survey and field work. And that latter piece allowed me to live and feel my research. I think there are some trade-offs with each method. So for example, you have to be mindful of bias and framing and your own effect when you're in the ecosystem you're studying, but it vastly enhances your experience as a researcher, enhances your research product as well, I think, to have those components. As mentioned before, I think the experiences of real people brings concepts alive. So for example, the reciprocal nature of remittance sending, it answers questions of how they explain their behaviors and motivations behind the economic activity you're observing. So I think I pulled a quote from my chapter I was going to read because I think that oftentimes those quotes are what brings things to life. So one woman we talked to, she said, "My daughter has her own necessities and her own expenses in the U.S. I don't want to pressure her to send money, so I only tell her a few of all of my problems so she doesn't worry. From the money she sends me, I tell her what I fixed so that she feels happy, so that she knows that the money she is sending is being used for something." And another memorable older woman we interviewed was using her remittance money to save up for a dress for her daughter-in-law and forgoing her own desires for higher quality coffee than the beans that were coming in rations. So TLDR, don't be afraid of messy subjectivity is one of the things I take from them.
I think I would just kind of echo what Anne has said. You know, what I really appreciate about both of these scholars is that they have a really careful study of human behavior, and they rely on, I think, what Peter Behtke would refer to as thick descriptions. So they're using different methods, you know, relying on field work, relying on interviews, relying on a lot of, I mean, just very careful, detailed investigation. And I think that they're both social science scientists, and at the end of the day, they both are just demonstrate that we need to understand the meaning behind human action. So they're aligning their methods with trying to get to that meaning. And that's certainly what I appreciate. So I also, you know, Stephanie and I have done field work together. My chapter relies on field work after Hurricane Katrina and then also field work after Superstorm Sandy. And then I think the other thing that was very interesting to me about bringing their work together is, again, really how similar they are in celebrating this diversity of institutional arrangements, right? So in the case of Zelizer, she's talking about commercial circuits, right? She's talking about why people come up with these particular economic arrangements. Maybe it is, for example, a distinct currency, right? So she talks about the hours. So Ithaca hours is a currency that was circulated for a time in Ithaca, New York. And there are very, you know, strong similarities, and I draw those out in my chapter with the institutional arrangements that Lynn Ostrom describes that are used to manage common pool resources. You know, I see those as like they're working very much on similar projects. And then at the end of the day, I think what their works do is really give us these incredible illustrations of human ingenuity, right? And really a profound celebration of, again, diversity.
Yeah, I think something that they both tackle is they're both looking at these really tricky problems that many academics and citizens and policymakers think need these huge one-size-fits-all type solutions. And they highlight how we have all of these ways of maybe not perfectly, but coming together on our own to solve problems that are worth looking at. You know, I think the idea, you know, Anne, you're talking about like the importance of money and how you interact and how you kind of earmark those things, right? That's so important of in Zelizar's work of talking about how like money isn't neutral and we use it in these particular ways. But then, you know, we think about like the commons and what Eleanor Ostrom was doing and showing, you know, hey, we assume that all these problems are in the world and there are plenty of problems, but here's all of these ways that we solve them. Like that ingenuity factor, Laura, I think is so important about what they do. So both of you and your chapters kind of grow off of this larger, these larger research projects you've been interested in. Kind of what motivated you to tackle the topic the way that you did? And maybe we can combine that with my second question, which is, if you wanted one thing, you wanted the listener and hopefully now reader of your chapter to get out of the piece, what would you want that to be?
Yes. Yeah, so what motivated me to tackle this topic in the chapter? So, you know, as I have mentioned, a lot of my research has been in the post-disaster space. And I kind of think about that as a context in which social cooperation and social coordination seems really, really hard. So especially if we think about something like Hurricane Katrina, we have extreme destruction. As many as 1,800 people lost their lives. Hundreds of thousands of homes are damaged, destroyed. Thousands of people leave New Orleans and they're faced with this decision of, am I going to go back to New Orleans? And will I even be allowed to go back? So the way that we have talked about this in our work, so this is part of the larger Gulf Coast Recovery Project that many different scholars from George Mason University and Mercatus Center have been a part of, including our mentor, Virgil Storr, Emily Chamley Wright, and certainly Peter Betke. But we framed that also similarly to, you know, Ostrom's work as a collective action problem, right? So if you are faced with all of these really high costs of returning and rebuilding, the benefits to you of returning and rebuilding are certainly unclear, and they're tied to the decisions of other people. So if you decide to return, but your neighbor does not, then your, in fact, benefit of coming back is reduced, right? So it might be in terms of the quality of the school district. If people don't come back, the quality of the education that your child receives could be different. The kind of third spaces that we enjoy, whether those are restaurants, parks, all of those really are determined by those who reside in our community. So all of that is to say, you know, I think that already I have been intrigued by this, these research topics of human ingenuity, right? How do people solve these complex problems? And so, Stephanie, when you approached me about maybe looking at some of this post-disaster research from the lens of Eleanor Ostrom and Viviana Zelizer, I think it made a lot of sense to me. So again, I think the closest, what I really relied on from Zelizer's work in particular was the idea of the commercial circuits.
Yeah, and I'd love to kind of go into that a little bit more. I think some of the examples you bring out in circuits, and these are things both chapters will dig into, so we'll have, I think, a lot to talk about across all of us. But, you know, after a disaster, money can be so tight. It's so complicated with insurance and federal aid and all of these things. But some of the ways community members pooled money and used money in these really interesting ways, I think, you know, show an important component of how you can kind of work these things out on the fly, which I think is, you know, also something that comes out in Anne's chapter with you need to learn how to kind of figure out how to help one another and kind of keep those things going as you go. Do you want to talk a little bit about some of the circuits that you highlighted in the chapter?
Yeah. So thanks for that question. So my chapter, again, is using the kind of case studies of Hurricane Katrina, and then in particular, the Broadmoor community that was impacted by the hurricane. And then More recently, Superstorm Sandy and the Bayswater community. So the kind of second case here in Bayswater is a very interesting example. The community, as we would define it, is the geographic area of Bayswater, which is on the peninsula of New York. And it's also a community that has this large population of Orthodox Jews. And in the aftermath of Superstorm Sandy, this community is impacted. There's flooding. People are without power for weeks as it's starting to kind of get into fall, winter months in New York. And in order to kind of deal with the situation, the community, of course, organizes. And in particular, we talk about an organization that is referred to as Achiezer, is one of the major organizing bodies. And then in particular, Achiezer has established a kind of community assistance fund that they had used in previous disasters or moments of crisis that they decide to bring back online. And they have kind of an infrastructure and model of how to both solicit funds and also how to distribute that money throughout the community. So what's interesting, and I think how it, you know, very much ties with Zelizer's work, is that this is something that's operating outside of the formal individual households program of FEMA assistance. The community wants to be able to offer this in part because they understand that their community has some different needs and ways in which their recovery might be a little bit more of a burden. I would maybe point to many of these families are large, so they have many children that they have to care for. I can't imagine caring for, you know, more than one or two, you know, three, four, five children when you don't have electricity or heat, right? And then on top of that, they also have particular dietary needs that mean that they can't just go to every grocery store and find food for their family. And those foods tend to be more expensive. So both of these things combined, both having these larger families, having particular dietary and, you know, lifestyle needs, I think is a reason that they decide to create this fund. And, you know, we didn't unfortunately have the chance to interview many people that donated to this fund, but we know that it was quite successful. So it was in total over $11 million was raised, which is quite a substantial amount. And you can imagine that the way that people, when they're giving to this fund, are thinking about that money is quite different from probably other money that they're spending in their day-to-day life, right? That there's a narrative about, you know, caring for others, caring for others who maybe they don't know personally, but are, you know, a friend of a friend, and helping people during a time that is extremely difficult. So yeah, it was, I think that this is such an interesting example. And I'd also just add on a quick note, it's an interesting example because it is also showing really these kind of social learning aspects that they were pulling off a particular model that they had created from years ago and continuing to kind of iterate and evolve as community needs change too. So that's, again, the second example in this chapter.
Yeah. And I think, you know, that part of learning off of a model, like here's this internal way we're going to help each other out, kind of set aside money for these issues that might come up. And then being able to grow that so quickly with the broader community that they have, I think is such a really cool example of how that can be utilized. And I think because you said these problems are so big and challenging after a disaster, we often like don't think that you could come up with funds that way, right? And so I think that example is a really great one. Anne, how about you? Kind of what motivated you behind this project and what do you hope people get out of it?
Yeah, part of it was the support that I got from my mentors, including Stephanie, and the monetary support from the Mercatus Center to be able to use multiple methods, because that can get expensive. And I really wanted to understand how people experience the economic, social, and political consequences of remittance flows. It also struck me that we're studying a region that is 90 miles off the coast of the United States. when I was 16, I first visited Cuba as part of a church missions trip. Ultimately, I chose to write my dissertation on this topic because it's a tribute to the resilience of my Cuban friends. We talked about ingenuity. Every moment, every interview that I conducted, there were examples of resourcefulness, ingenuity, resilience. They've had to overcome numerous barriers that were incomprehensible to me at age 16. Things like, what do you mean you're not allowed to leave the country? And what do you mean it's not possible to buy eggs in the store or bread? What do you mean you live on an island but aren't allowed to fish offshore? That word resourceful is part of the Cuban story and identity. I remember when I arrived in the airport in the latest trip and was in a friend's car and they used thumbtacks to pin up the upholstery and it was a 1941 Chevy. He told me about how he was able to get replacement tires from abroad through customs by leveraging knowledge of how to navigate those barriers, including bribery. So when I first read Ostrom, I knew it to be true. People on the ground are resourceful. They use local information to coordinate with friends and family abroad to receive aid. They do not solely rely on government provision of aid, and they figure out ways to get around regulatory barriers, from paying others to bring money and things across borders to hiding cell phones inside of TVs so they wouldn't be confiscated by Cuban customs. Set a limit on number of cell phones you could bring because there was so much resale going on inside the country. To add on to the examples of circuits that we found, remittances are one of, I think, the cleanest, clearest examples of circuits. Zelzer defines them as distinctive bounded arrangements of social relations that sustain economic activity. She also recognizes four components. The first is a well-defined boundary that distinguishes participants from non-participants. So family or friendship, like a social connection, is an example of that. And we found that in all cases of remittance sending, there was that type of relationship. Secondly, it requires a distinctive set of transfers. So like monthly payments, annual payments, things like that. Thirdly, distinctive media. So money is an example, but we often found that remittances took the form of goods, sometimes technological goods like computers and cell phones. And then fourth, a shared meaning, which I got at in the quote that I was talking about before. It means a lot to those that send to know that their loved ones are helped. And it means a lot to those that receive that money to know that they have that meaningful connection abroad with their loved ones. So hopefully we can get into more examples of what exactly that looks like as it plays out in people's lives. But also, I hope that folks at the end of my chapter ask themselves, is the embargo or policies that restrict remittances worth the social and economic cost? And worth the interruption and destruction of these economic circuits? In the chapter, we estimate that the policy changes that happened in 2019, and I'll go into what those are, they affected between 12 and 36% of remittance senders from the U.S. to Cuba by either restricting the amount of money they wish to send, there was a cap that was put on that per year, or by limiting those to whom they could send money. In particular, at that time, donative remittances or remittances from someone who doesn't know the person who was not directly connected to via family ties, the person they're sending to, was prohibited. Several months after our survey ran in 2020, the main company that facilitated wire transfers to Cuba was forced to suspend services because of U.S. policy. A financial entity that they interacted with in Cuba had ties to the military, which was the source of that policy change. We weren't able to understand exactly how this affected the folks that we had already done the survey with, but it is surefire that a vast majority of them were affected because most of them used Western Union as one of the means of getting money to the country. In good news, Western Union just resumed this year limited services. They found a new financial institution to operate with in Cuba, and thankfully, last year, the caps and limitations on sending remittances to friends were lifted, but there were three incredibly difficult years for people who were just trying to get money to people they cared about.
I think that's a great thing to focus on, because I think one of the things that Ostrom and Zelizer and in your chapter really brings out is that we rely on our community and we use resources within our community to do so much of our lives. And policy can have huge impacts on that in a way that, you know, maybe serves a political or strategic purpose of, say, punishing a totalitarian regime. And it has costs as well. And it's not just the obvious costs, but ties and shared meanings and ways that we interact with one another. You know, I think if as people interested in analyzing policy, we don't think about those costs, we really miss out quite a bit.
Yeah. I mean, I would, you know, Anne's talking about the kind of policy questions in regards to our relationship with Cuba. And I think that in the post-disaster research, there are many, many considerations around policy as well. You know, I certainly hope, unfortunately, we have in front of us some, so here we're talking in early September of 2023, and we have the fire that has devastated Maui, right, in Hawaii. And, you know, I hope that after someone reads these chapters and learns about some of these community arrangements, whether they were in New Orleans or New York, they're kind of, they have an ear for hearing those stories as they relate to disasters moving forward. And I hope that we will kind of ask ourselves the question of, well, what are communities doing to respond? And, you know, I think that if there are graduate students that are interested in reading this chapter and thinking about this research, I would just say again that doing field work is so important. So Anne has talked about traveling to Cuba and talking to people on the ground there. That's obviously more difficult than traveling to another part of the United States, assuming, you know, that you are in the United States. And being in areas that have been affected by natural disaster can be really hard. But I think that the sacrifice that we make, if people don't go in and do that work, if you don't seek out community members and try to understand that perspective, it kind of, it silences those voices and they don't become part of the story of, you know, New Orleans and Hurricane Katrina, right? Instead, all that we hear about is kind of the highest level of maybe federal response. So, you know, I think that just having people there to record these stories is really important. And I'd also, you know, say certainly related to if we wanted to look at more specific policy questions that might come out of this chapter, it might be, you know, generally thinking about in situations where communities are rebuilding, what is the best way to approach that rebuilding process? How much say do individual residents have? Are you going to, for example, try to create a larger scale plan and kind of piece in communities according to a larger view of what maybe the at a city level you wish might happen? There have been some really interesting comparative studies here that thinking specifically Daniel Smith and Daniel Sutter did, comparing the rebuilding efforts in Joplin, Missouri to Tuscaloosa, Alabama. So those are both areas that were affected by tornadoes and had very different approaches in rebuilding. So Joplin, you know, quite centrally located near several states, allowed contractors from other states to come in and engage in rebuilding, gave businesses, homeowners, the ability to do that. Whereas Tuscaloosa decided that they were going to kind of take that disaster as a pause to more centrally plan their community. And that, you know, ultimately, I think really slowed down efforts. And then business owners, residents ended up relocating to other places. So certainly that's one of the policy implications. And I think another, you know, policy implication certainly is that, you know, at a minimum, when we think about disaster aid, we ought to recognize that there are federal programs that FEMA is there to support communities, but there needs to be some coordination and giving, whether it is you know, ACIESR, Broadmoor Improvement Association, giving those entities recognition and trying to help them in their efforts rather than crowding out some of the bottom-ups aid.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, both of the chapters really look at these really hard times in people's lives and how we can make it harder, but also how there's ways that we can make it easier. And so, you know, kind of really thinking through all those options is super important. I'd like to ask this next question of just in the process of writing these chapters, was there anything particularly interesting or surprising that you learned or discovered, whether it's with the framework of Ostrom and Zelizar or the fieldwork that you kind of dug into of kind of what surprised you as you were going through this process?
Yeah, so many things. I think many people think of remittances as money transfers. People, sometimes professionals, bringing cash through airports or Western Union wire transfers. But it became clear in earlier visits to the island that many remittances were in fact things: food, medicine, cell phones, computers, some of the odder ones I came across, things like condiments and spices or soft drinks from America, tires, TVs, pet food, children's Tylenol, bras, and a hair straightener. One other tidbit of information that really impacted me was that over a half of consumer purchases are made for family and friends. This was an observation made by Deirdre McCloskey. I remember being shocked when I read that and looking at my own bank account, and sure enough, it was true. Dinners and gifts and travel, all of that could be tied to some social reason, whether it was like going to a family's wedding or a gift for a bridal shower. The takeaway there is that love and social connections drive exchange. And the way that Zelizer puts it is social arrangements facilitate economic ends. And insights from my own research reinforce these findings. So over 70% of those with transnational ties to Cuba saw remittances as beneficials to those who received them. Of those sending remittances, 49% saw them as a way to express love and commitment to family or friends. 19% noted that they sent remittances because their family and friends depend on it. And 25% saw it as a way of giving back to family and friends who've helped them in the past. Another 13% saw it as a gift. Note worth noting, people could choose more than one option in this survey, but it was still an overwhelming indication that many people tie it to a familiar or love-related piece of meaning for them. In terms of who they send remittances to, 53% sent to at least one close family member, and an additional 46% sent to a more distant family member, uncles and aunts, cousins, grandparents. And 16% sent them to friends in addition to family. So that's that donative remittances piece. Additionally, you could see that there was a reciprocal element to this, because 58% of those who send remittances communicate with recipients daily or weekly. And everyone communicated at least once a year. So once again, social ties are intertwined with economic activity.
Thank you. Laura?
Yeah, I mean, So again, I think there were all sorts of things that were surprising to me when I really got into understanding post-disaster rebuilding. And I'll kind of riff on this Deirdre McCloskey point, because I do think that there's an interesting way in which, you know, Zelizer's work, there's some similarities between Zelizer and McCloskey. So again, if we think about disaster as really being about how people respond to some of the most difficult situations, what I think is just so fascinating, when I first did the field work in New Orleans, I was quite a bit younger. I was probably naive in my understanding of my own country, and that I really didn't fully appreciate the diversity of the United States. I mean, I interestingly had the opportunity to travel overseas, right? So I had been to South America, I'd been to Europe, I'd been to even Southern Africa at this point. And yet, kind of walking through New Orleans, I felt like I, again, was in another country. So the, you know, the culture of New Orleans is just so different from what you would find anywhere else in the country, in the world. And in fact, that's a theme that people kept telling us as we were talking to people, whether it was in the Ninth Ward, whether it was in Broadmoor, was how there's no place like New Orleans. And I think, you know, Deirdre McCloskey is very critical of homo economicus, right? And I think what Zelizer and Ostrom do is really talk about how different each community is and to have a deep appreciation for those cultures that do exist. And once you can do that, then you can understand the logic of these systems that they are working through. So, you know, it makes sense that in a place like Broadmoor, it's a diverse community, and yet everyone had a very strong sense of this is the kind of microcosm of New Orleans. They kept track of each other as, you know, fellow residents that were celebrating Broadmoor, celebrating New Orleans. And through that, they had a neighborhood association. They kept careful records. They were able to find each other after the storm. And that was a key part of also kind of proving viability and that over 50% of the community was going to come back, was just locating people. And then if you look at the Bayswater community in New York, again, there's this really strong sense of community that is certainly around religious views, but it's also just the kind of rituals of the daily life that are involved in being an Orthodox Jewish person. I mean, living in a pretty close-knit community because at least on Saturdays, you're doing, you know, a lot of travel by foot. You have to rely on each other in certain ways. And so when we see that there's something like the community fund that comes about, it's not particularly surprising because, again, they can call on those really strong ties that then kind of launch themselves into other communities that they're soliciting aid. But, you know, again, maybe to summarize that is, you know, what I find so surprising is that even within one state, there is diversity in these communities and how all of those characteristics then are kind of mapping onto different ways that they're engaged in problem solving, whether it's post-disaster or some of these other crises.
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the things that's really interesting kind of listening to both of you talk, you know, back to back about these ideas is there's so much, I think, overlap and interesting tensions that maybe even in the academic literature, we haven't teased out, right? And so, you know, I know from Anne and my perspective, we see how remittances and development and issues of migration are so similar to disaster recovery because we've worked on both. You know, one of the things that's really fascinating to me is we have this term of remittances if you move away to another country and you send money back, but we don't really have that within the country, right? And so when we look at some of these examples of how much you actually have to rely on your family and ties and community after a disaster, it looks really similar to remittances. And so with Zelizer, I think we kind of have a way of talking about them to show their similarities in a way that we don't have to, you know, kind of, we should be able to show, hey, look at these are all circuits, but we're using these types of things all of the time. And I apologize with my dog is making lots of noises today. So he's got a nice background. He has a lot to say about this topic maybe as well. Yeah, so I want to kind of think about what's next in these ideas, right? And so both of you know quite a bit about the literature of your individual topics. I think both of you have done quite a bit to bring in these ideas from Ostrom and Zelizer and other thinkers into these fields. What would you say is the next questions that you'd like to ask and study or that you think others should as you kind of move forward?
Yeah, I would like to see an extension of the Commons Governance Research Program to collective action in online spaces, like video games and virtual protests and online communities, and like how things like Wikipedia and that degree of information resource come about. There are examples of this type of work already, but as more interaction moves online, I think that understanding how the aspects of the online piece of the experience, things like anonymity via a username or not having to be confined by the features of the physical world, like gravity and strength in a digital space, but also things like the characteristics of your physical body not confining you if you can represent yourself digitally as something else. And lastly, differences in the scarcity of physical versus digital goods, because you can really play with that. A lot of games and experiences will artificially limit the amount of in-game resources, but that can change. And then also how all of those things impact the ability of individuals and communities to govern, to set rules, to hold each other to them, and to detect and punish missteps.
Great. I think the online space is also ripe for Zelazar circuits, because there's so many ways in which money can be treated kind of separately and special in those areas too.
Very valid point.
Laura, how about you?
So I guess I find myself thinking more about, you know, making explicit the terminology of self-governance and democratic systems and this whole shared project of democracy that we have. And again, thinking about it as a national narrative of kind of us versus them, that we are divided. I've been reading, of course, some David French on, you know, divisions in the United States have never been more severe than they are today. And I guess I have some questions about whether that's true. I have some questions about how we might think of cases where communities have been divided, but then found ways to work through some of these issues. You know, if I think about the economic sociology literature, I would put kind of the study of social capital in there. And part of the way that we define, you know, social capital is, if we're going to look at, you know, someone like Robert Putnam, it would be civic activity. Right. So I wonder, as we're looking at another national election and just, you know, trying in the wake of COVID, trying to be, you know, full community members again, is there a way that I'm moving more kind of out of maybe natural disaster spaces and more into what are some of these concrete, you know, well, not always concrete, but social problems that we have, whether it's on housing or, you know, just disagreements related to K through 12 education, and how are communities exercising voice, coming up with unique solutions that fit their particular characteristics. So yeah, that's what's on my mind.
You know, just small questions.
Just small questions.
Yeah, I think one of the things that's struck me about, you know, as we look at these examples and particularly can highlight how policies can make them harder, you know, how, you know, say the remittances, and in a particularly tough time, policies can make that even harder for people to survive because it's not really thinking about community. Same way with disasters. You know, I think both of your examples show that this appreciation of community shared meaning really trickles into so much of our lives that all of these questions that we can come up with that could become political or be centralized, right, need that approach from, you know, from a community-based approach.
Yeah, and I'd love to add, like, one of the findings and the applications of Ostrom to the example of remittance circuits in Cuba is this idea that polycentric systems exhibit resilience because they're not dependent on the functioning of a single node, such as a central government. So even when there are these impedances like policies or political or economic circumstances that make living in a country very difficult, people find a way to get around them. They're resilient to these changes. That's one of the key parts of the story of the chapter.
Yeah. And I'm curious if, you know, kind of my instinct, and I think kind of the question to explore is that, you know, when we think about politically divided in such a national level and those certain things, right, we actually have a lot more resilience and commonality to people if we bring it down to a more everyday level, right? And so sometimes when we push those conversations, we miss that as well. I don't know if that's what you're thinking as well, Laura, with some of these ideas.
Yeah, I mean, I think some of it too is, again, at what level are we hearing the stories, or is the social science being done, right? Because I think it's done at the highest level. You know, you could tie this to even sources of information, newspapers. So much of it is national now that you don't hear about the problems and the problem solving that does happen at a more decentralized level.
Yeah, absolutely. So as you're thinking about sort of, you know, what, as we're thinking about what's next, I guess another thing for us to ask is, you know, for a reader and a listener of the podcast and a hopeful reader of the book and the chapters, if they got interested in these ideas, where would you want them to go next? Reading different books or thinkers that you think are important in this space?
So I guess there are two books that I was thinking of. You know, the first is my effort to encourage all of us to do field research and interviews and to be talking with people so we can get these, that we can get to the meaning of action. And so the book that I have always relied on there is The Learning from Strangers by Robert Wise. So he talks about, you know, it's both an art and a method of qualitative of interviews. And then the other book that I think is just so interesting and that was certainly part of the Katrina study on narrative, so narratives and social science research. So that's the title of a book by Barbara, it's Zarniowska. You know, she provides some really interesting ways to think about narrative and how narratives are passed within a community to kind of encourage collective action, and certainly is the way then that is what colors people's perceptions of events and informs action.
Anne?
I have two suggestions. The first is called North Korea's Hidden Revolution, How the Information Underground is Transforming a Closed Society. And this is, the author is spelled J-I-E-U-N and then B-A-E-K. This book is full of circuits. That language isn't exactly used, but it is also about how remittances, how digital item or items, often digital, and information get into the country. Another one is Tom, I'm going to also get this name wrong. His last name is J-J-E-L-T-E-N. He wrote a book called Bacardi and the Long Fight for Cuba. And this intertwines the history of the Bacardi rum family and business, which was Cuban, is now, I believe, based in Puerto Rico, with the history of the Cuban Revolution. And it's a really great example of social science and story intertwined.
Awesome. Thank you both. Is there anything else that you guys would like to make sure that we talk about today?
Can you also recommend a film? Have you seen the Cuba and the Cameraman?
I love that documentary. Thank you both so much for taking the time this afternoon to talk about these ideas. And I hope our listeners go forward by reading this book, checking out your other research, and digging into the other suggestions that you brought up as well. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for inviting us.
Thank you for listening to the Hayek Program Podcast. To learn more about the research, scholars, and work of the Hayek Program, visit hayek.mercatus.org. For more information about graduate student fellowship opportunities for students at Mason as well as at universities across the globe, please visit students.mercatus.org. We hope you recommend students to our programs or consider applying yourself.